Welcome to Influential Visions Podcast. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. In this series about imposter syndrome, our regular host, Nathaniel Schooler, is joined by Kim Adele Platt as they interview leaders from around the world, sharing how they overcame their inner imposter.
Going to talk about overcoming imposter syndrome today and confidence levels at work. So I'm privileged to be joined by Kim Adele Platt. She's an experienced board leader and C-suite executive coach with over a decade in the boardroom, championing human spirit and empowering a compelling culture that attracts and retains top talent. So, yeah, I mean, we've been unpacking this topic for nine months or so, right? And imposter syndrome is just so huge. And what I found very interesting was actually where we kind of started and where we're at now, and how imposter syndrome really goes alongside the confidence levels that people have at work, right? So yeah, I think it's very interesting what we've been doing here.
Yeah, no, it has. It's been a fascinating journey. And as you know, I've been on the journey about imposter syndrome and understanding it probably for about the last 3.5 years since I identified that it was time to stop talking to myself the way that I had been talking to myself. So having spent 20 odd years in financial services and IT software, I was terrified that people would find out that they'd put the hairdresser on the board and they'd go, oh my God, get her off. And obviously they didn't do that, but I had that fear, living with that voice inside your head and desperately trying to ensure it doesn't come out of your mouth. So you're trying to say one thing to your people and in board meetings, etc. And all the time that little voice is saying to you, you shouldn't be here. They're going to find you out. You're not enough. You can't do this. You're not good enough. And it's debilitating. It's an awful way to live. And it wasn't until I had an illness and needed to go and write that letter to my little girl, that one to give her all the advice in case I didn't make it. And I remember going to look in on her because I didn't know where to start. And it suddenly hit me that the voice we talk to ourselves becomes the voice we teach our children to talk to themselves. And it was like the world stopped. Certainly my heart did, because most people that know me think that I'm kind, caring, considerate. I've always got an ear to listen. And they wouldn't think I could be cruel. But if only they knew, if only they'd heard some of the words that I used on myself, some of the language, the total disrespect and disgust I had for myself for a lot of the time, they'd probably have a very different view of me. Because I said things to myself I wouldn't say to another living person. I wouldn't do that to anybody. And I realised that I didn't want that to be the legacy that I left to Scarlett. I didn't want to teach her to talk to herself in the same way. And therefore, I had no choice but to go and do the work, to understand why was I like I was? Why was I so unable to see any value in myself? And as you know, that's when we identified that actually it comes down to our I am statements. And we all have I am statements. These are usually formed by the time we're 7. They're enforced by the time we're 14. And they're pretty much embedded by the time we're 21. And what happens is they become part of our belief system. So for me, mine were I'm not enough, I'm not lovable, and I'm always alone. So whenever anything happened in my life that meant that that was likely an outcome, it was like putting another leg on the table of your belief. So the belief is the tabletop, the I'm not good enough. But every time something happened where I got it wrong, where I made a mistake, where something didn't quite go right, that would become another leg on the table of that belief until before long, I had the most stable table you were ever going to have. But the beauty is that we've learned from doing the research is that you can actually dismantle that table and build your new belief system, because our subconscious brain is the happiest little helper we're ever going to have. Its problem is it doesn't understand the difference between helping and harming. So when we tell ourselves something that's actually harmful to us, like I'm not good enough, it runs off to try and help us. So it goes in the library of our mind and it pulls back all of those examples where we got it wrong, where we weren't quite good enough. And they become those legs on the table. But what we're learning is we can reframe that thinking. So asking ourselves, okay, I can get it wrong. I understand that. Are there any examples where I get it right? Because again, that happy little helper is going to run back into that library of your mind and come back with all of the examples where you got it right, where you did achieve what you were looking to achieve. And they start to become the legs on the table of your new belief that you are good enough, that you can do this. And I suppose my third tip is my little girl is my North Star. And like any biased mother, I believe as long as she is kind and she tries, that there is nothing in the world that that little girl can't do. And so now what I do is think, well, actually, what advice would I give her if she were facing this situation, if she were facing this opportunity or this challenge, what would I say to her? Well, I'd say, sweetheart, as long as you're kind and you try, what's the worst that can happen? Go and do it. And so if that's the advice I'd give her, that's the advice I have to take for myself, because children don't learn by what we say. They learn by what we do. So we're now learning that actually in those moments when that inner critic comes out and starts to try and chip away at you, the reality is that inner critic is your inner child and it's childlike maturity of thinking. So it's trying to keep you safe. But what it really needs you to do is reach in as the adult you and say, it's okay, I've got this. Hold my hand, we can do it. Because it's time for the adult you to now move forward. And I think once we can kind of see that, we realize that actually that inner voice isn't trying to harm us, it loves us. It's actually there because it's trying to help, but it's letting the child run the show. And actually what we need to do is say, it's okay, we've got loads more wisdom and more knowledge and more experience now than we had when you formed those beliefs. So let me help you build new beliefs and together we can move forward.
Yeah, well, we've delved into this topic on, you know, multiple interviews, right? And at this point now, we're coming towards the end of our series that we've been doing. And it's absolutely fascinating that the levels of confidence differ so much in the world, right? Like certainly in the entrepreneurial world, people are a lot more delusional, I think, than they are actually in the normal, you know, working world of the corporate kind of monster, right? Which is where you've been for like 30 years, right? And it's much harder to be in a corporation than it is to be an entrepreneur, because if you've got those delusionary kind of beliefs in yourself, they will find out quite easily and say, well, have you done it before? Well, no. Are you able to do it? Well, I've never done it and I don't think I've got the skills to do it, so no. But like, then there's the other side of it, which is the imposter syndrome, which is this is kind of my understanding of it, which is where you think people are just going to find out how bad you are. And actually, you might be really good at something, though. But they're going to find out that you're useless at it, right? But actually, in the scheme of things, you've probably done it hundreds or even thousands of times during your career. So It's not like a self-confidence thing. It's much worse than that. It's deeper than that, right? So it's not, I mean, me, I've studied myself since we've been doing this, and I've been kind of going through the kind of, you know, I can do it kind of belief, which on occasion has been probably delusionary, right? But eventually it becomes a fake it till you make it thing, and then you actually become very good at it. But like, I wouldn't want to go and operate on someone's brain, right? So you know, like these sorts of things that we're doing with our confidence levels are really, really important, because then we can kind of over egg our abilities, or we can underestimate them. And I didn't suffer from it, but I sort of did. Like, and I think everyone has, they're somewhere on the spectrum, aren't they, between, happy and not happy in this respect, yeah?
Yeah, and you can swing, you know, you're not always, you know, sometimes at my worst, I was like full-on imposter ranting in my head, couldn't move forward from it. But then I've had, you know, other examples where actually I've gone, well, no, I can do this. I've been doing this for a lot of years. I can believe that I'm quite good at this. You know, I've spent the last 10 years being employed by corporations around the globe to do transformational change. And I always get them back on referral. So it's people that know that I can do it or have passed my details on. But that's where I learn about borrowing belief, because actually we think about, I must know what my purpose is. We talk a lot about knowing our purpose, knowing our why. And it's important that we know our values, but everything we do is built on a belief system. And it's not something that we talk about yet in organizations, but what we need to do is build our belief muscle. So actually, what is the beliefs that we want to underpin the organization? What are the beliefs that we want to underpin our leadership? And one of the beautiful things, one of the greatest gifts that there is in the world, is to lend somebody your belief in them. And I've been really fortunate. People have lent me their belief in me lots of times. And I've learned to, rather than use my own thinking, which is, if only they knew, Kim, they wouldn't be doing this. No, actually, that's one of the craziest things. Because as somebody who suffers or suffered with imposter syndrome, I don't think my opinion is better than anybody else's. In fact, I don't really rate my opinion very much at all, which is why I think I'm not good enough and I berate myself on all these things. But inadvertently, what I'd been doing was disrespecting and disregarding people whose opinion I did value when it came to me. So when they give me an award or they gave me an accolade or they gave me an opportunity, I would be there thinking, they don't mean that, or if only they knew, or if I got, you know, if I will get found out. And then I thought about it and went, well, that's interesting. You're making your opinion more important, more valid, more right than their opinion. And that doesn't ring true. It doesn't sit well with me. So now what I do is I choose to borrow their belief. And then I do everything I can to make sure I don't let them down. And that seems to be working. But it also taught me that I can do this for other people. I can lend my belief to other people. It's what I do in my coaching business, but it's also what I've been doing in those transformational change pieces. It's being able to create that organizational belief system that allows people to know that they're trusted, that they're empowered, and that they're engaged. And that actually, when we bring people in to work with us, we bring them in because they're talented, because they're bright, articulate, intelligent people. And they can probably do things we can't do. Certainly when I employ people, I'm looking for people to do the things I know I'm not very good at, because it's the power of the team. But in doing so, I'm therefore going to have occasions where they know more than I do. And that's okay. And it's getting to be comfortable as a leader to go, I don't need to know how to do your job. I just need to know how to lead you. I need to know how to ask the right questions to seek to understand. And I need to know how to guide. And I need to listen to understand rather than to interject. And when you do that, then the whole culture piece changes. Because if you think about it, if I were a film director, and this would be enough to terrify anybody that's listening, but if I were a film director and I just put Helen Mirren in a role, I'm not going to micromanage how she brings the character to life, because she has earned the right to bring that to life, to interpret that how she sees fit. That's why I'm picking her. The same is true for anybody I choose to employ. I choose to employ them because actually they've demonstrated that they've got the skills, the intelligence and the education, the presence and the experience to actually do the role I'm asking them to do. So how they bring that to life becomes theirs. My role is to direct. It is to make sure that they know where they're supposed to be going and helping them, but much more in a coaching way, much more in seeking to understand. And I realized that, you know, for many years, and you know, I thought being a hairdresser was my vulnerability. And I now realize it's my superpower, because as a hairdresser, they teach you to listen to understand, because you need to know what's important to your client. And then you want to try and create that for them, to create a space where they have a memory. That's leadership, because you want people to go out feeling a feeling of increase, that as a result of you, they are better. Because this is our job. As soon as we get into leadership, our job is about the people. And very often we can get hung up on managing the bottom line, managing the numbers. And I've had somebody say to me once, well, it's right for you, Kim, you just do the fluffy people stuff. And I remember saying back to them, that's really interesting. You know, in the 3 months that I've been here in your organisation, I've put £350,000 on the bottom line that I can prove based on your statistics. And he seemed a little taken aback. And I said, well, if you look at your absence rate, what it was and what it is now, just looking at the amount that you used to pay, that's put this on your bottom line. And if you also take away the amount of people you were losing in attrition and the backfill cost of that because you were having to rehire, those two sums added together are 350,000 before we put on the opportunity cost. These people are now in the building, so they're able to make more sales, they're able to deliver a better service. And you've retained talent, which means you've retained knowledge, you've retained experience. So there is probably some of the top line figure that is also as a result of what we've done. So it might feel sometimes like the things that we're doing feel fluffy, but having ran organisations and been responsible for budgets in the hundreds of millions, I know these things work. And it's about, if we manage the people will manage the performance, and then we all win, because our role is to help them thrive.
Right. So in what about communicating impact?
Yeah, I think that's one of the key things. You know, we all have had those moments, haven't we, where we've got to go and deliver a difficult message. We've got to go and do something that we're feeling really uncomfortable about. And what happens when we get into that? There's a great book called Crucial Conversations that I recommend to literally everybody because it's amazing. And it says, you know, whether it's in life or in business or just in general, there are moments when a conversation becomes crucial. And by that, what we mean is it feels like there's quite a lot of emotion in there, that it might go wrong. And what happens is we respond with either violence or silence. So either we get very assertive, very aggressive, very loud, or we walk away. We'd like remove ourselves, or we say nothing. Neither one of those actually resolves the problem. The problem's still there. It's still bubbling. And the next time we have a conversation, it's still kind of creeping around in the back. A little bit like, which is probably why I'm divorced, you know, when you have an argument with your partner and you bring up the fact they didn't empty the dishwasher in 2002, and you're like, really? We're not over that yet, are we not? So it's what we're not doing is kind of dealing with it and then moving on. But if you frame things, if you create a safe space for people, then you can deliver any message in the world, whatever it is, with impact and with kindness. So even those really awkward ones, you know, I've had to do some really challenging ones recently with sorting through things with my ex and for my little girl, particularly with the challenges of COVID. But I don't want to get into arguments. So what I now do is say, start with letting them know that you're a bit conflicted. So, you know, I'd rather stick my head in the oven than actually have this conversation. However, I know that we need to have this conversation because we need to find a solution that works for both of us. And I'm 100% committed to finding one that works for all of us.
Okay.
And here is a suggestion. This might not be the right suggestion. It's just a starting point for us to have a discussion. And the reason why it works is you start off, you share a little bit of vulnerability. I'm really conflicted about having this conversation. I really don't want to do it, but I need to because it's the right thing to do. Yeah. And I'm committed to finding a solution that works for everybody. The reason that's important that you put in something like that is it means that you're not wedded to the idea you're putting forward.
Right.
You're saying this is a way of doing it, but let's discuss it. You're allowing that other person to contribute to the solution. And therefore, they're going to be much more predisposed to want to come into that conversation. And it might sound like this is really simple, but having run 7 major redundancy programs without having a single grievance or tribunal, I know that you can deliver one of the toughest messages there is to deliver and do so in the right way. And I've done those and had people hook me on the last day. And I would be like, please don't, because I'm the one that did this. And they're like, we know, but you treated us with respect. You treated us with kindness. Because at our core as human beings, irrelevant of age or race or gender or culture.
Imposter syndrome affects 70% of us at some point. If this is affecting you, click the link to get help.
We want to be listened to. We want to be understood. And we want to be respected.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean to say we can't disagree, but but we can't disrespect. And I think once we learn that, we become so much more impactful.
Okay. So, and that is a way of limiting the imposter syndrome that people are feeling, because you're basically bringing a culture of the right behaviors within that business, right? Like, that's the whole point of putting this in the conversation around imposter syndrome, right? Because without that culture of, I'm not going to say touchy-feely culture, because it isn't touchy-feely, but it's almost like you just have to understand where other people are and try not to belittle them by delivering a message in the wrong way. Is that fair to say?
What we're saying is, you know, we were all designed equal, and we still are. We might have a different role, but that doesn't mean to say we're more important, we're more valid. I remember years ago going to talk to one of the guys that was on the phones, and I was COO at the time. And he turned around, he was like, I can't talk to you. And I was like, why? He was like, you're proper important. I was like, it's so ridiculous. I'm just a person. I've got a job to do. If I get my job wrong, then we've got a problem. If you get your job wrong, we've got a problem. But, you know, last time I checked, cut me, I bleed. I'm pretty certain if I cut you, you'll bleed. Please don't tell HR I said I was going to cut you. And he laughed and he was like, you're actually really normal. I was like, because I'm a person. And when we remember that we're people first, and actually, I think, you know, we've spent years doing things like we've got user experience, we've got customer experience. Where's our human experience? Because every user and every customer and every colleague is a human being, as are we. So if we started to think about what is the best human experience I can create here, that's going to really drive that space. And the other thing is to help eradicate imposter syndrome for people is we've got to move away from this belief that we can't share vulnerability, because we've been told for years that whatever happens, do not share your vulnerability, don't show it. But if we learn how to share our vulnerability without losing our credibility, we have a significant impact on our culture, because what that does is it allows it to be okay to not be perfect. It moves away from that piece where we've got to know everything, we've got to be perfect, because everybody is vulnerable about something. We've all got something in our lives that we hope nobody finds out, that we hope doesn't get discovered. Mine for many years was that I was a hairdresser. I hope nobody would ever find it out, because I thought that was going to be the thing that lost me my career. It's probably been the thing that's propelled my career. I now share that with people, which is, you know, you might think you've not got the right qualifications, you've not gone to the right schools, you've not gone to do this. Do you know what? I've got an MBQ in hairdressing, and that's it. And it hasn't stopped me having the career I've had, and it hasn't stopped me from building the business that we're building. But actually, it's taught me something. So sharing some of that, I did a speech before we went into lockdown, where I stood up and I had that moment that inner critic took over and was like, what on earth are you doing? You can't possibly know what you're going to say to these people. And I wanted to run away. And I remember standing there and looking at this room of people and saying, do you know what? Right now, every fibre of my body is telling me to get off this stage and run as fast as I can. And I can't do it for two reasons. First, I don't think I could run very far in these shoes. And the second, I'll never come back from it, because my name and my picture is plastered all over the brochure. So you will know Kim Adele Platt's run away. So I can't do that. But what I can do is give myself permission to share with you that that's how I'm feeling. And in doing so, hope I can quieten this little voice long enough to get on and tell you what I'm here to talk to you about. And I thought, well, what was the worst that could happen? They could all get up and walk away again. She doesn't think she can be here. She's got nothing valid to say. It didn't. People stayed. And I had people queuing at the end to come and talk to me, because they said, you stood there in a bright red dress with bright red lipstick and a huge beam on your face. And we were like, this woman's never had a confidence issue in her life. And yet when you shared that, when you said, like, this is how I feel, we knew you meant it. And I said, yeah, because sometimes we have to find a way to hack our way to confidence. So every time I feel really nervous about something, I will put on a brighter dress, put on brighter lipstick, put on a bigger smile, and I will fake myself confident. Because when you appear confident, people treat you like you're confident. So just looking at it and saying, what are the ways that I can create that culture for people where I'm confident enough to say, do you know what, I get it wrong? Or I don't know that. You know, I will often stand up in town halls for major organisations and people ask me a question that I don't know the answer to. I say, I don't know. I can give you my opinion, because what I don't want is you to think that I'm afraid to answer the question. But it will just be my opinion. What I will then do is go and find you the actual answer. And then I do. I go and find them the answer and I come back. And I remember somebody saying to me, why do you do that? I was like, because it's about being genuine. It's about being authentic, bringing our whole selves to work, because only then can we really lead people.
Very much so. I'm very interested in this whole thing. And, you know, I can't thank you enough for spending all this time with me and going through this. And, you know, mastering one's mindset is just so important. And this kind of lays at the base of it, right? Because without that awareness around your confidence and your abilities and your personality, right, you kind of just get lost, don't you, in yourself, right, without awareness. And that's what's amazing. Working with you is absolutely delightful. And so if people want to find you, they can go to kimadel.org, yeah?
Yes, that's right. And I'm loving working with you too. And I think you're so right on the whole mindset piece, how we pick our mindset, and finding a way to pick your mindset is really useful. So one of the things I do, I'm not saying this will work for everybody, but just as a final shot, is I pick a quote every single day, a quote that means something to me that allows me to go, do you know what, I'm gonna do this. And I can find quotes in literally anything. But one of them, which actually comes from Frozen 2, was to just take the next right step. You might not be able to see the whole solution. You might not know what the end outcome is. But if you can see a right step to take, take it.
Thanks, Kim.
Thanks so much for supporting our show. Please do share this episode with your friends and business associates, and click the link below to subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, take care.